Thanks, Corey. So I was involved in an effort from 2003 to 2013, a campaign to make the morning after pill available over the counter. So this is after sex contraception. It was available only with a prescription in the US. And when we started, dozens of other countries already had an over-the-counter status for it, or didn't need a prescription in those countries. So, thanks to our campaigning and a lawsuit, the FDA finally recommended making the pill over-the-counter for all ages, which was one of our big demands. And the administration of newly elected President Barack Obama overruled it. He said he didn't want his young daughters to be able to buy this pill. So we were a little bit surprised about this. I mean, we had grumbled about the Democratic Party, but it still largely seemed to support reproductive rights, and here we were talking about a contraceptive. When we started the campaign to get the morning after pill over the counter, I was working for the Red Stockings Women's Liberation Archives, and we launched a project to look more closely at how it was that opposition to birth control had become mainstream again. We thought we would make a short pamphlet. And 15 years later, there's a book, so that's how that happened. So what we did is we looked at the history of birth control restrictions in the United States. We looked at the drop in US birth rate and establishment reactions to it. We looked at the situation in other countries. And we looked at our own experience of having and raising children or deciding not to. And I'll just give you a taste of what we found. And there are a lot of different threads. Please ask me to elaborate or just make a note if something's unclear. And also, we have books, so I would be happy to sell you a book after the session. So for decades, we've been told that abortion is just a wedge issue. It's used by Republicans to split working class Catholics from the Democratic Party and to excite a Protestant evangelical base. Feminist law professor Joan C. Williams explained recently, starting in the 1970s, Republicans have offered support for working class anti-abortion views in exchange for working class support for pro-business positions. So you've probably heard this theory. It's sort of Thomas Frank with What's the Matter with Kansas. That's his position on the origin of anti-abortion politics. But according to this view, politicians and the 1% don't really care one way or the other about abortion. They're just using the issue to get votes. Well, we looked back at the history, and in 1873, when birth control and abortion were completely banned in the United States, the chief reason given was that the birth rate had been declining. Married women were, quote unquote, avoiding the duties and responsibilities of married life, unquote, resulting in smaller families. And families had gone from an average of 8 children per woman in 1800 to 4 children per woman in 1900. So it was a significant drop in those years. Political elites feared that women were abandoning their child-rearing work at home to get jobs. And they worried that Protestant native-born women were using abortion to limit births, while Catholics and recent immigrants were having lots of children. An Ohio Senate Select Committee convened in 1867 asked, quote, "Shall we permit our broad and fertile prairies to be settled only by the children of aliens?" Unquote. If not, the committee said, native-born women must be convinced not to have abortions by making the practice illegal. So this may sound kind of familiar. It sort of reminds me of that representative from Iowa, Steve King, who's been tweeting about immigrants and the immigrant birth rate and the native birth rate. So skip forward 150 years, and the US birth rate has dropped below replacement. It's now considerably below the 2.1 children per woman required for a stable population. In fact, it's now at a record low of 1.72, and it went down since I published the book. Which came out in March. And as in the 1870s, the US's answer has always been immigration, more immigration. But to make up for the current drop, we'd need to have something like 3 times the immigration we have now. And immigration, at any rate, is just displacing the work and costs of having and rearing children onto other mothers and other parents in other societies, all for the benefit of employers in the United States. As corporate apologist Ben Wattenberg put it gleefully, immigrants are men and women who have been raised and educated on someone else's nickel. When we compared our situation to Europe, where the birth rate is as low or lower than the United States, we found that there the birth rate is openly discussed by politicians and in newspapers. Efforts to raise the birth rate have mostly focused on making it easier to have kids by fully funding childcare and providing long paid leaves. And then in some places, like Turkey and Poland, leaders have attacked reproductive rights with the open goal of raising the birth rate. In others, like France and Sweden, where there are stronger feminist movements, the governments have been promoting policies that support parenting, and they've experienced somewhat higher birth rates as a result. And then some countries, like Russia, are doing both, increasing maternity leave and government payments to parents. At the same time, they're gnawing away at access to abortion and contraception. But in all cases, the reasons for the policy are out in the open. How can we get more babies? And that question has led some to an answer that echoes feminists, which is equality at work. Stefan Kronert, a Berlin demographer, explained, "For a long time, politicians said the high participation of women in the labor market is responsible for the low birth rate, because when women go into the labor market, they don't have children anymore. But interestingly, when you look at Western European countries, the fertility rate is higher in countries with the higher labor market participation of women." Referring to the difficult conditions for German parents with school days that end at noon and little provision for childcare, Kronert said, "Women who decide they want a modern life with financial independence and their own professional career are very often deciding to have no children at all. The lack of childcare makes women dependent on their husbands, and most women don't like this." In an article called "Breaking the Baby Strike," The Economist explained the falling birth rate in Turkey. "Ask Turkish women about work and motherhood, and the response is a torrent of grievances. Husbands do little housework, employers are unsympathetic. In short, mothers are generally still expected to stay home, and until that changes, Turkish women will perceive a sharp choice between work and parenthood, and often go for the first." U.S. journalist Stephanie Mensimer puts it more bluntly. She says, "Conservatives thought if they only made it harder for mothers to work, women would stay home. Instead, women stopped having kids." Well, in our group, the falling birth rate made perfect sense to us. Many of us were in our 30s, and we could clearly see how the difficult conditions we faced were causing us to decide to have fewer kids. In a consciousness-raising meeting in 2015, we went around the room and we discovered that several of us had stopped at one child because we found it just too difficult to conceptualize having a second. The cost, the exhaustion, the double day of working for 8 or more hours and then coming home and doing 8 hours of care work and cooking and housework. It wasn't that we didn't want a larger family, and many of us had siblings and we wanted to have that kind of relationship for our kids, and but it was just too hard. And then those of us who had male spouses were already doing more work at home than they were, so that was also an issue. And then just the work of rearing one child was already as much as we could handle, and in some cases, people said more than they could handle. And then some of us who didn't have kids testified that we wanted them, but it just didn't seem feasible, given unreliable health insurance, jobs that didn't provide leave, and all of these other conditions of not being able to afford it. And then from watching our mother's struggle, we believed that it would put us possibly in a sexist trap that would squeeze the rest of our lives. And we also found that our spouses were hesitant too, given their work lives or their economic circumstances. There are 16 of these testimonies in the book. So we believe that all over the country, there are people like us who are blaming themselves when they want kids and they don't see how they can make it work. They're thinking, well, if I gone into a better paying profession, or if I could find a job with real paid leave, or if I were brave enough to quit my job and go back home where my parents live, if I could just find the right childcare arrangement, if I'd only found a spouse who worked fewer hours, if I hadn't gone into so much debt for school, if I could find the perfect cheap apartment. In other words, we see it as something we individually did wrong or could change, rather than understanding this as a system that requires our unpaid labor to function. Well, at this point, establishment think tanks are now loudly fretting about our lower birth rate. They worry about flagging consumer demand, immigration, and what they see as its attendant political problems, problems for them, an aging workforce causing rises in entitlement spending, by which they mean Social Security and Medicare, and how to keep the U.S. military strong when both the working age tax base and the supply of young people to enlist are shrinking. Well, given these anxieties, their focus on the family, as in the ultra-conservative group, focus on the family, makes perfect sense if by family they mean women and femmes and women's unpaid labor. Russ Duthat, the New York Times columnist, explained why large families are required. They make it easier to cut government programs. Here's a long quote from him. One of the things we've seen over the last 30 years is that in the absence of government programs, people aren't able to function usually as atomized individuals. You need some intermediary institutions if you're going to have small government. So you need strong families. You need people who are willing to have large families, for instance, which can then help provide for them in their old age. So if Republicans are serious about reforming Social Security, by which they mean destroying it, or finding a way to increase the number of young workers paying into the program, then having a country with higher population growth, larger families, is an obvious and conservative way to do it. That's the end of the Ross Duthat quote. So we call their program Small Government, Big Families. And to the brain trust around focus on the family, or people like Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, marriage is not about love or companionship to face the challenges of life. The family is a reproduction unit for children. And the point of marriage is to have babies. I mean, he's very explicit. He talks about how marriage equality will lower birth rates. In his book, It Takes a Family, which he wrote as a rebuke to Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village. To Santorum, anyone who deviates from the heterosexual marriage and lots of kids model must be punished in order to get everybody to conform. And this seems to be the underlying motive for a lot of the anti-LGBT politics and discrimination that we're seeing right now. Might explain the big money behind the appalling anti-trans bathroom bills and all these other attacks that we're seeing at this point. Worries about the low birth rate cross the political aisle. Philip Longman of the centrist New America Foundation writes in his book, The Empty Cradle, that capitalism has never flourished except when accompanied by population growth, and it's now languishing in those parts of the world, such as Japan, Europe, and the Great Plains of the United States, where population has become stagnant. Liberal Stephen Philip Kramer of the National Defense University wrote a book in 2014 called The Other Population Crisis, What Governments Can Do About Falling Birth Rates. In it, he writes, declining birth rates constitute a problem for the survival and security of nations in the broadest existential sense of national security. For several hundred years, economic growth has been tied to growth in population, increasing the size of the domestic market and labor force. Well, even as these thinkers raise the alarm about low birth rates, this sea change has gone largely unnoticed by feminists. This is probably because second wave feminism arose starting in the mid-1960s during the brief 20-year period when government planners were panicking not about low birth rates, but about high birth rates. They were in a tizzy about overpopulation, both domestically and abroad. And for feminists, this period is burned in our minds because it was characterized by horrific reproductive coercion in the form of forced sterilization aimed at women receiving welfare and women of color, in particular African Americans, but also Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, and Native Americans. The sterilization operation was so common, it was called a Mississippi appendectomy, and in Puerto Rico, simply la operación. This population panic and the forced sterilization that accompanied it lasted two decades from the mid-50s to the mid-70s, coinciding with the period that the feminist movement built into a second wave. But it's a different world now. There's one abortion clinic left in Mississippi and it operates under extremely restrictive rules, and there are about 55 crisis pregnancy centers also. Half of the world's population now lives in countries where the birth rate is below replacement levels, and in 10 years, the United Nations projects that 67% will. Still, many feminists continue to suspect the power structure is preoccupied with too much population, especially among the low-aged and women of color. And this has caused us to tune out, even as establishment think tanks agonize about low birth rates and warn of worker shortages and decry aging populations. So there was a moment when the union movement was strong that US employers were forced to put in resources towards the care and child-rearing job. For a time after World War II, people expected the wages of one full-time male breadwinner to pay his expenses, and it was always his, and those of his spouse and their children, and it was called the family wage, right? It was a union demand. And it was used as the excuse to pay women less, in fact. But starting in the 1970s, as wages stagnated and costs rose, households kept up by sending both spouses out to work, meaning that each couple is now generating 80 or more hours a week of work for employers where it had been 40. The job that the non-wage earning spouse used to do, child rearing, housework, and caring for sick or frail family members, is no longer included in one worker's paycheck. Instead, it's squeezed into the few hours left in the day after paid work. Well, the family wage was sexist because it locked in discriminatory pay and it made women dependent on male breadwinners. But at least it meant the employer was contributing resources towards the family care job. Now, we don't have any support for that job. Well, rather than go back to the sexist system of the family wage, which made women reliant on men for survival, we argue the feminist way to arrange a care economy is to go forward to an increased social wage, which is the term they use in Europe to describe services and benefits that everybody in the society gets. The most obvious is healthcare systems where everyone's guaranteed full coverage no matter what, as opposed to it being through your spouse and your spouse's job and or not being able to get it at all, which is was my case for many years. But also universal health, universal child care with a unionized workforce and national standards, free like the public schools, paid family leave for both parents, paid sick leave mandated by law, and shorter work hours. German workers work 10 fewer weeks a year than we do. And if we look at it as we've actually doubled the output for each family, the other way we could look at it is we should all be working a 20-hour week for the same amount of money that we are making now. So I want to go in a little bit more into immigration. Immigration has been described as the American solution to the employing class's problem of lower birth rates. And it is the employing class's problem. I'm not saying it's a problem for us. But immigration has always caused a lot of discomfort for the ruling class, and it's a contradiction that's been a recurring theme in US history. As we saw in the 1870s and then at the beginning of the 20th century, immigration and the birth rate were often discussed in the same breath. If native-born women don't have more children, we'll be overrun by immigrants. Fear of Slavs, Jews, Catholics, and Chinese have been replaced with fear of Latinos and Muslims, but the alarmist claims are the same, right? They're disloyal, they'll bring foreign ideas, an alien religion, class conflict, crime, drugs, they won't assimilate, they'll come to outnumber real Americans. Still, this distaste for outsiders always seems to yield when employers need their brain and muscle. These days, while Democrats have largely embraced immigration as the answer to low birth rates, the Republican establishment is split. One faction supports immigration, while the other complains that immigrants will demand government benefits, vote for Democrats, and even bring class four, we can only hope. But even the pro-immigration side worries that the flow of immigrants is unsustainable politically, and lately they've even been worrying that the supply will run out due to declining birth rates in the sending countries, for example, Mexico. Pro-immigration Republicans, and to be clear, they're pro-immigration, they're not pro-immigrant, they're quite candid that they favor immigration to compensate for the low birth rate. The late Ben Wattenberg, who I mentioned before, who was with the pro-corporate American Enterprise Institute, wrote, "The baby born 9 months from now won't even start paying into life's Ponzi scheme for a generation. And that happens only after we spend a lot of money to raise and educate the child. A quicker fix would be instant adults. As it happens, they are available immigrants. Rotenberg is letting slip a truth that I think is often hidden in the immigration debate, and that is that immigration is this colossal ripoff of the labor and resources and of the mothers and parents and communities and countries that immigrants leave behind. And this reverses the mainstream narrative that immigrants are a drain on the economy and should be grateful to be here. In fact, Mexico, India, the Dominican Republic, and other sending countries are subsidizing U.S. employers by raising workers to adulthood. The Koch brothers, who are hardly known for their concern for the well-being of immigrants or anyone, have been pushing Congress to allow people brought to the U.S. as youngsters to stay. So they actually are in support of the DREAM Act. This is a sign of these splits in the Republican Party. And even Trump, while he sends troops to the border to block women and children fleeing violence in Central America, supports adding 30,000 slots to the H-2B guest worker program. Because the thing they all agree on is they don't want immigrants to have rights, either on the job or in the community. And this is why they're favoring crackdowns that terrorize immigrant communities. At the same time, they're supporting these guest worker programs. They want to push people into the guest worker programs, which give employers complete control. You know, if you don't work fast enough, if you object to wage theft, you can be instantly deported under these guest worker systems. And in keeping with their desire not to spend anything to raise and educate their workforce, both Republican factions oppose family reunification. You are starting to hear a lot more of this, which, from their perspective, brings non-workers like parents and children who might need health care and education. They're very explicit about that's the reason that they don't want it. So as long as we think of the battle over abortion and birth control as primarily a cultural conflict in which the two sides simply hold different worldviews, it's not really clear why corporate owners and establishment planners would have much interest one way or the other. They seem to be sort of like disinterested referees in this culture war. But if we look at it as a battle over the production of humans, how many, how fast, and at what cost, it seems likely that employers as a class would have an intense interest. And they would especially care when they're called upon to put in resources, as they are whenever we demand paid family leave or child care. So a reversal of our declining birth rate does serve an economic goal, an ever-expanding workforce raised with a minimum of public spending and a maximum of women's unpaid work. Why would employers pay for parental leave if they can get away with not providing it? Why would corporations pay taxes for a national child care system if families can be induced to take that burden upon themselves? But women and all parents are refusing, as our lowest ever birth rate demonstrates. And that gives us, I think, a little leverage. As the birth rate goes down, the value of our unpaid labor raising successive generations can be seen more clearly by everyone. So we think it's time to bring the battle out into the open and raise some demands. What's a strike without demands, after all? So our proposed program is first to show how the US economy relies on women's unpaid work, with employers and the rich benefiting disproportionately but making little contribution. Second, we want to defy the expectation that women and femmes will work a double day, a full day of work for pay, and then 8 hours more of unpaid care work and housework in the home. And then third, use the new consciousness of the value of our work and the leverage of our spontaneous birth strike to win our immediate demands for guaranteed health care, paid family leave, lots of it for both parents, child care, and shorter work hours for all. And I should say a couple of words about my group, National Women's Liberation. It comes out of the 60s Women's Liberation Movement, two groups, and specifically Gainesville Women's Liberation in Gainesville, Florida, which is the first women's liberation group in the South, and Red Stockings in New York, which was sort of legendary for breaking up an abortion hearing and starting their own hearing, which is now an archive. And we use consciousness raising to study our situation and figure out what we want. And I have in addition to the book, I have some study guides. They're also available online, but I have a few copies here too if people are interested in doing study groups or consciousness raising groups around some of these issues like healthcare and childcare. And we also teach classes. We have chapters in Florida and New York. And we have a Women of Color Caucus, which studies the intersection between male supremacy and white supremacy. So I just want